Hi, and welcome to Terra Nullius Cyprus. I'm Costa Constanti. We're here on the Island Talks channel. Thank you to our sponsors, the CVAR Severis Foundation, for giving us the space to record our podcast here at the Gleridis Library Room, and also Limoncello for their delicious foods and drinks. I have a guest with me today, all the way from Australia, although her roots come from Agros in the Drodos Mountains. I have the beautiful, the funny, the charming, the suave, the intelligent Ellie Simons. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Costa. I can't believe that introduction. Okay. I feel very honoured and privileged that you think of me in that way.
Well, look, it's all for the podcast. You know, in general, I'm kidding. Now, I've known you for many years, for transparency. Yes. I've known you from when we were just children in Melbourne.
Yes.
Going back over 25 years.
Yes, about. I believe so.
Now, I've known you for so long, so I'm a little bit biased. So I know a lot about you, but I want to give you a little bit more control as to our discussion today. But I will just give a very brief summary to the things that you do and who you are. You're the daughter of Cyprus. You're a daughter of Agrodes. You grew up in Melbourne. You were married. You're now divorced. You had three children. And you have been active in civil society, in governance. You're the vice president of the Parthenon Marbles, the Return of the Parthenon Marbles movement, as the Australia rep. You're involved in many diaspora activities and issues. That's just a very holistic summary. Now, if I'm to nitpick at you, there's so much I can pull out. Where do you want to start? I'm going to throw this out. Normally, I don't let my guests choose where to start, but I'm going to let you start.
Where to start? Look, yeah. I'm a big fan of sequence, so we should probably start at the beginning.
Okay, so where you were conceived. Where were you conceived? Well,
perhaps not quite that early.
Were you born in Australia or in Cyprus?
I was born in Melbourne.
You were born in Melbourne.
My father, as you have said, he hails from Agros in the Drodos Mountains, Bitsilia. And it's a very beautiful part of the world. My mother is actually from Greece.
Yep,
my
mum
is from Ithaca. Ithaki, a fabled Homeric island of Odysseus. So I hail from two very beautiful and historic
unique islands.
Yeah. And both of those DNA origins, I guess, have really profoundly impacted me. I guess when I was a child in Melbourne going to primary school, I realised we were a little bit different to the Aussie kids at school. But, you know, I mean, I felt Australian as well, but I always felt that, you know, I had this other part of me that wasn't really expressed in our Anglo kind of primary schools and things.
What suburbs did you grow up in?
I grew up in North Blackburn, tiny little suburb. And then,
so not a very ethnic, so to speak.
No, it was pretty white bread. Then my father had a vision. Mm-hmm. My parents had a vision to build a beautiful house in Templestowe. And so my parents were some of the first Greeks to actually go out to Templestowe, and they built a beautiful mid-century. They got an architect. It was an absolutely beautiful home.
Did it have columns and lions out the front?
No, it was nothing like that. It was in fact, we sold it a year ago. Our family sold it a year ago. Mm-hmm. We had it for 50 years.
Wow.
And it was put up in websites of mid-century design. It was really very beautiful. So we were very lucky to grow up in such a beautiful home. My early life was spent a lot in the city. My father had cafes in Russell Street and then in Exhibition Street, but particularly in Russell Street, they were my formative years.
What kind of cafe was it? Was it a Greek focus one?
Yes, no. It was like a bistro. It was a coffee lounge, you know, from the 60s. It was Greeks were very famous in the, well, there's a very big tradition of cafes in the city, in Melbourne City, that were a Greek ownership and a long tradition. And in fact, my grandfather, my mother's father, my Ithacan grandfather, had cafes in the city, in De Grave Street, in Elizabeth Street.
Yeah. And anyone from Melbourne would know straight away.
Oh, areas, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, De Grave Street is a very hip place to have cafes now, but De Grave Street, Elizabeth Street, and one other one, Flinders Street.
These are all commuter points as well. So business they were, must have it was gone
near,
well.
There were two of them were near Flinders Street Station. So, yes, my mum tells all sorts of stories about her years growing up in those cafes. And in fact, we are about to be featured in Leonard Yanisevsky and Effie Alexakis' next book on Greek cafes.
You might want just I want to grab that because I'm waiting to go back to Australia, or maybe they'll come to Cyprus and I want to interview them as well.
Yes.
But just amazing, give us two people. Sentences on what they do, because their research on the Greek cafes and milk bars.
Yes. Leonard and Effie have put together, collaborated for many years, 30, 40 years, and they're life partners and collaborators in their archive. They have travelled Australia in research of the most extraordinary cafes and Greek food outlets, Greek cafes, milk bars, these kinds of things.
Yep.
And the historical documentation that they've done, photojournalism, and Effie's the photographer, Leonard is the historian, and they have now just donated their archive to the Australian Archives.
I saw that on social media.
And it was announced this morning, and I congratulated them. They are really a remarkable couple, and the work they've done to document, like, there is a wealth of history in early Australian cafes that were run by Greeks. You know, we invented all sorts of things, and I remember those things being, my mum remembers those things being served in my grandfather's shops. And
I think the cafe culture of Australia had its birth in the Greek migrants.
Now, very much so.
Because of these guys, on my way to New South Wales, on my way to Sydney from Melbourne last year, I stopped at the halfway point near Gundagai.
Right.
In Gundagai, I should say. And I went on purpose to the Niagara Cafe, which was a Greek institution. Very it actually famous. Still has a Greek flag on the top of the building. It's owned by others now, but, you know, they've done some amazing work. So, yeah, their names again?
Leonard Yanisevsky and Effie Alexakis.
Look them up, the milk bars of Australia, the Greek milk
Greek
bars
milk
of Australia.
Bars of Australia. And many country towns were famous for their Greek milk bars, and they were sort of Art Deco period. They're,
they're beautiful.
They are quite extraordinary.
Imagine your New York diner meets a Mediterranean cafe. That's what they look
they're
like.
They're pretty amazing.
Now, your parents, coming back to your parents, so they had these cafe bistros in the centre of Melbourne. How long did they work them? They worked them right through to the end? Or
My dad had his sort of around 1960 when he married my mum, and we lived in North Blackburn. He commuted every day, and it was actually open 18 hours a day from 6 a.m. till about midnight, and served lots and lots of people throughout the day. It was an institution there in Russell Street, and it was right near the Greek centre of Lonsdale Street, which was on that corner of Lonsdale and Russell, but the Greek precinct sort of went down into Russell Street as well, to Little Burke Street.
The previous generation knows about this. The current generation, just for context, it's basically like the Eaton Square in Oakley of the city. This was where all the Greeks hung out back in the day, the Cypriot Greeks.
Yeah. And the length of Lonsdale Street, and also down in, I mean, my Ithaca house, which is the, I mean, the Ithacans were the oldest historical society in, you know, they had their centenary not that long ago, actually. Yeah. And it's actually older, the Ithacan society is actually older than the Greek community, I believe.
Yep.
So a lot of those Ithacan businesses were around Elizabeth Street. A very famous one was A.J. Lucas. Mm-hmm. He was the first president of the Greek community.
Yep.
He became very, very wealthy with the most extraordinary cafes. One was the Capitol Cafe in Swanson Street, which was designed by Walter Burley Griffin and his wife Marion Griffin.
Walter Burley Griffith was the one that designed Canberra.
Correct.
Those are the capital city of Australia.
And it was the most extraordinary art ticket. They were very famous in that period. And so that is a beautiful, beautiful building. And he became very famous and very wealthy. So there are a lot of Ithacans in around Elizabeth's, Flinders Street, Swanson Street. And then the next wave post-war migration was where sort of Lonsdale Street really sort of took off. And
how old was your dad when he went to Australia?
My dad went to Australia in 1951. He was 19. So okay, he had grown up in Agros, and fortunately in Agros there was a high school there in the region, and it was in Agros. So he was the youngest of five children, and the old and youngest by far. It must have been a lovely little surprise for my grandparents. So the older children were sort of off and running and sort of already had gone to Lef Corsair. And so my dad was very clever, and my grandparents were able to afford for him to stay at school. So and fortunately for him, there was a high school in Agros, which just opened in the early 1930s or in the 30s. Yeah. So he was able to go from primary school to high school.
Why Australia?
Well, I'll just finish with his story. He had 4 years in high school there in Agros, and then he went to stay with his brother in Lef Corsair and in Paluriotissa, and he went to the Samuel School. And fast forward, I did not know this. I found this out at my father's funeral. One of his school friends came up to me and said, I went to school with your father in Lef Corsair, and the school was called Samuel, which was extraordinary because my eldest son was called Samuel, and my father never told me that he went to a Samuel school.
Samuel, it's the precursor to the grammar school, right?
It was. They did teach English there. They did conduct classes in English. So his matriculation certificate, which he had English, and it was in English. And because of that, he went to Australia in 1951. His brother was already there from 1948, and an uncle. And it was pretty tough for him when he arrived, and he enrolled and was accepted into Melbourne University Faculty of Law. And I have that letter, and I found it in his archives. 1954, he was accepted into the law faculty. And so that was... Well, I'm just so proud of that achievement. That's an extraordinary achievement.
Might be something in the water in Agros, because didn't our President Glirides...
We did. He's a distant cousin of ours too.
So, okay, so he ends up in Melbourne. He was accepted into law at Melbourne University. Did he actually go?
He did. He did 2 years. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in those days, I mean, obviously, I mean, studying law is a very difficult thing. And can you imagine studying it in your second language?
Yes.
I mean... My Greek is probably a little better than his English when he arrived in Australia, but I can't imagine for a minute studying law in Greek. So it
was... And at the same time having to adapt to a new country, have an income.
So he did actually do 2 years' worth, and it was difficult, or A, because of the language issue, but also he was working at night as a waiter at the Menzies at Rialto. There weren't many evening places open in Melbourne in those years. And
the
so he supported.
Not in the modern day.
At Rialto was a hotel in Collins Street, very famous. He served Elizabeth Taylor once, and she told him to personally. She beckoned him over, and she said, "Now, mind you, don't spill anything on my $3,000 dress." So that was in the 50s. So that was one of his.
You remind me of my
stories.
Grandfather and his story with Sophia Vembo when she visited Cyprus.
Yes,
that he had befriended her and did her favors. Well, yeah, go. I digress.
Anyway, so he ended up in he didn't finish his law degree, unfortunately, because he would have been the first Cypriot born graduate of Melbourne University Law School had he completed it. And there were other people that achieved that milestone later. But he ended up in restaurants, and so I grew up in Russell Street. Near the Greek community and the Cypriot community, which my father was one of the early founders of, that original group that bought the building in Heffernan Lane. And he was one of the founding benefactors. And in fact, he and Mr. Tumburu, and I remember my brother reminds me of this, Mr. Tumburu came over to my dad's house one Sunday, and they sat there on the dining table and actually signed over as bank guarantors our house. And Mr. Tumburu's house were guarantors of the loan that bought Heffernan Lane. And so my mother was freaking out, because this was at the beautiful home that I just mentioned to you. And Mr. Tumburu also had a beautiful architect design mid-century
huge
home.
Risk,
and
a
so
great
they
dedication.
both our homes were on the line for that Cypriot community in Heffernan Lane. But I remember then, 1974, obviously, the invasion. I was a young girl. I was watching the 6 o'clock news, and we had all these visions of Makarios and the coup and this and that and the invasion, and it was just on the 6 o'clock news, obviously, in those days. So that was a pretty difficult time. So then in 1976, my father was also one of the founders of the Worldwide Justice for Cyprus efforts, which I believe began in the US, but the Australian contingent was very active, and my father was one of the original members of what became SECA, Justice for Cyprus Committee of Australia. Anyway, in 1976, they organised a conference in Cyprus, and a jumbo jet was chartered from Australia, and I was on that plane. I remember at the time thinking, oh, these planes are pretty nice. I realised a couple of decades later we were sitting in first class. That's why it was so nice. I mean, my brother and I were running around playing cards. We thought it was just a...
So the bar was set high.
Yes, we thought everyone travelled like this. But obviously, you know, as the organisers, we were at the pointy bit of the plane. Anyway, so I do remember that conference. Well, I didn't attend the conference, but my parents did. And I have photos of them with President Makarios, and obviously that was a very difficult time. And then not long after that, the Cyprus community in Heffernan and Lane became a hub of support for the war, for the refugees.
I remember from older uncles of mine telling me that with this moment, collecting blankets and clothing and charity funds and sending it to Cyprus.
Well, we were there every weekend having fundraising things. Every Saturday night there were dances, fundraising dances. They had, I recall, a large exhibition of Lefkaritika that they'd brought to sell. All sorts of things for several years. And my father personally sponsored people. I mean, the community sponsored people to come, but my father personally sponsored 15 to 20 people to come. He made sure that they enrolled in English classes. He gave them work in his cafes. He organised many Bruxenia weddings.
It's kind of ironic that the late 70s became this huge wave of Cypriot culture and migration and whatnot coming into Australia, because obviously a lot of them were refugees, but it wasn't just refugees going to Australia. It was also Cypriots from Limassol and Paphos. That were going to Australia purely because of the economy of the country of the few years after the war.
It wasn't just refugees. Yeah. And in fact, my cousins and distant relations that came from Agros, they weren't refugees, obviously. Exactly,
But you know, basically the Cypriots went from being quite a small diaspora group to a huge one in the late 70s.
Yes, I think.
And not many of them did return to Cyprus. The majority, vast majority
some
stayed.
Some of my cousins did actually about 20 years later. But look, many stayed, obviously. I think there's about 50,000 Cypriots.
There's 80,000 in Melbourne alone.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, it depends on the stats you look at, but it's the second biggest, after London, it's the biggest diaspora community. Yeah.
Yes, we don't have a name like the Chadli this. We should have a name, shouldn't we?
Kanguro.
Kangaroo. So that's my early life. That's my dad. My mum grew up going to MLC private school. My Ithacan grandparents decided their daughters weren't going to mix with the Anglos, so they sent their daughters to private schools. And so my mum grew up in the leafy suburb of Kew, and went to MLC. And I went to MLC later. And I really loved that school. It had a cross-section of people from all over Melbourne. A lot of demographics were represented. There were some Greek girls there. Not many, but there were. There was a Greek club there, I remember. But I had a wonderful time at MLC. I really thrived there. I was academic and sporty, so that served me very well.
Well, look, let me take that opportunity. Speaking of sporty, I know that one of your earlier careers was as a model. You know, now we're going to make her blush. Yes. I mean, you still should be doing that. You're still beautiful.
Thank you. You
know, as you enter your later years.
My mature years.
I was going to be cheeky now. Yes. No, but you were a model, and I'm not saying that is a past tense, but professionally speaking, you were a model back then.
Well, the story I have there is actually – quite a nice one. There was a very, very famous Ithacan woman in Melbourne called Ellie Lucas.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And she was actually a friend of mine, an acquaintance of my grandmother's. My grandmother's maiden name was Lekatsa, so that in anglicised is Lucas. So this wonderful woman, Ellie Lucas, was a very famous model in Collins Street in the 1950s, and she opened up a school of deportment. And of course, because I was a city girl and I grew up in the city, it was just de rigueur for me to attend Ellie Lucas's school of deportment. So I was actually fortunate enough to be taught catwalk by herself. I mean, she took these deportment classes. And, you know, catwalk isn't just, oh, you get up there on the platform and walk up and down.
No, but I'm sure there's it would have had a method lot to, do.
Now, to it this, and choreography.
I'm going to use this as a segue to the next step because I want to jump along. Now, there's modelling and there's modelling. Now, I know you're a very confident, dynamic, forward, assertive person.
Okay? Thank you.
Now, that would have helped you and your self-esteem and your confidence. But then the next stage of your life, we're going to jump a bit now.
Yeah.
But you end up getting married to somebody who in Australia is quite famous.
Very famous, yes.
Red Simons, for those that don't know.
Yes.
Now, Red was huge. I mean, like anyone who grew up in Australia would have heard of Hey Hey It's Saturday, would have heard of the band Skyhooks.
Yes.
So quite famous. Now, that would have thrown you as a young Ellie Simons back in the day, would have thrown you straight into the deep end of the public life.
Correct.
You would have become very familiar very quickly with the media, with the paparazzi, with the ugly side of it as well. How was that? How did it go from being this little Cypriot girl of diaspora migrants?
Nice Greek girl from Templestowe.
Yeah.
Well, because of the modelling, I was fortunate enough to be selected as a Big M girl, and that was a very big thing at the time.
Big M is the big famous M. milk.
It was huge. There were only 20 Big M girls, and we were sort of sent around Victoria to promote milk, the Victorian dairy industry. Mm. But they decided to go for a very sexy, glamorous campaign. So the Big M girls were, you know, known to be pretty glam. Yeah. There were calendars and all sorts of things. So that period of my life was actually a lot of fun. I was at university at the same time. So that was my uni job. I didn't have to be a checkout chick. I could go and be a Big M girl in my downtime from uni. And I earned pretty good money and I started buying shares. I was obsessed with the share market. Anyway, so that was a really lovely period of my life and exciting and fun. So when I met my husband, I was 23 and I'd already travelled overseas for a year, worked in London, travelled around Europe and been a Big M girl and a model and what have you. So by the time I met him, he was older than me, quite a bit older than me, and he was had been extremely famous sort of in his second career. The first incarnation was Skyhooks in the 70s. Everybody knew Skyhooks in the 70s.
Yep.
And then Hey Hey It's Saturday in the 80s and 90s was absolutely huge. So, yes, I was in the limelight, but I was familiar with it. It wasn't, cameras don't bother me. I don't mind a camera. I got used to it. I was around Channel 9. I was around the media. There were paparazzi from time to time. There were red carpets. There were interviews. A lot of people came to our house to interview us, you know, reality TV programs, you know, Burke's Backyard cooking shows, all sorts of things.
Yep.
They all came and interviewed us at home with our kids, all sorts of things. Or, you know, we did the Bert Newton show with the kids sometimes to review holiday movies. And, you know, we spent a lot of time at Channel 9 and in the backstage in makeup, in the green rooms, and it was an incredible period. I mean, Saturday always had incredible guests, and I had a little bit of a moment, a fleeting moment with Tom Jones. I have to say, he was absolutely extraordinary. I think he opened a door for me. He'd gone out to have a cigarette, and I was going to the car park or something, and he opened the door for me. He looked at me. I felt for a moment there had taken my clothes off with his eyes. I mean, it was, the stare was incredible.
You didn't throw your bra at him like everyone else does?
I didn't, but I was just like, oh my God, that was Tom Jones. He just opened the door for me and stared at me, gave me that look. I mean, I was probably, you know, 28 at the time.
Yeah.
God only knows how old he was. But anyway, we got to meet incredible people. We met Mick Jagger. We met all sorts of people. I mean, it was fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. And yes, it was the glory days. It was the Bond years of Channel 9, and Hey Hey was winning awards, so we were always seated at the front table at the Logies, and
just the Australian equivalent of the Academy.
So yeah. You know, I always had to have a lovely frock, and it was a lot of fun.
How old were you when you had your first son?
I was 26 when 26. I had Samuel.
Yep.
So I was 26 and I had Samuel, and then we decided that, well, I'm home for one child, so I might as well be home for two. So we had a second one, Raphael. Mm-hmm. And so it was all, that was the fairy tale, you know, yep. The wedding, the media, all that fun, and two beautiful babies, and it was
how long after the,
amazing.
How long after did Joel come along?
5.5 years.
Was he an accident?
No, he was very much on purpose, okay. But
I just wanted to have a little stab at Joel.
Yes,
there, no,
that's okay. He might be listening to this. Well, of course, then we had a very difficult period. Mm-hmm. So that fairy tale bubble suddenly burst one day, and I will tell that story. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course.
So one day when Samuel was 4 and Raphael was 2, Samuel went off to kindergarten. As normal, there was nothing wrong with him that morning. We got a phone call in the afternoon that said, you need to come and pick him up, he's not well. So we went to pick him up, we brought him home, and he had a headache. He had a terrible headache. He couldn't sort of open his eyes. He was in quite a lot of pain, and he was just very listless. And he didn't have a temperature. So normally, we'd just had the season of the flu. Normally, when kids are that sick, they've got a fever. He had no fever at all. And like within an hour or so, I just said, this child needs to be in hospital. Like, mm-hmm. And then we called my parents to babysit the two-year-old, and they came down, and my husband and my parents were both sort of thinking I was overreacting. I just knew.
Your instinct.
I just knew something wrong with him. This is not normal. So we ended up at the children's hospital via an ambulance and whatever, and then within a few hours he was in intensive care. Yep. So he was having a massive brain hemorrhage, and this is why he had a headache, and why he couldn't open his eyes, and why he didn't have a temperature. So anyway, that catapulted us into a whole other world. And the bubble burst, and it was a very serious matter. And so within 2 weeks, he was in intensive care for 2 weeks, I lost a lot of weight. I was on a morphine drip. They did MRI scan, and they said, actually, he has a brain tumour, a very serious one. So we were cut every fork in the road. At first it was, look, the brain hemorrhage. We don't know what's caused that, but, you know, it's probably going to be okay. Look, he might be a paraplegic though. But we'll do an MRI scan. And then they found the tumour. And then when they operated on the tumour, it was the worst kind of tumour, and it was a mess. Mm. So
that was like 4 years of age,
It
right?
was 4 years yep. of age. So we had 30 days in hospital where Bill, he lost weight, I lost weight, we all lost weight. We were just, you know, and he was going to die. He was going to die. That was it. And, you know, I was barely 30. Mm. So I knew, obviously, our life was never going to be the same again, and it wasn't the same again. So basically we spent the next 5 years trying to keep him alive. The fact that he was alive after one was the miracle. Mm-hmm. They said, at the beginning, they said, take him home and enjoy him. He wasn't going to last 3 months. And it did metastasize, and we did have to have radiotherapy, which is pretty brutal to a
4-year-old,
a pediatric brain, brain development. So that was a horrific period. He didn't die in 3 months, nor 6 months, nor 12 months. Nor 18 months. So we started to think maybe things were going to be okay. Mm-hmm. But slowly, slowly he went off to school. I had to find a way to – this is sort of the key to how we survived the whole thing. We had to figure out a way to raise him. Each day thinking that we might lose him, but we had to, while we had him, we had to convince him and convince ourselves that he was actually going to be okay, because How can you tell a five-year-old? How can you treat him like he's going to die? But in front of you on that day, he's very much alive and he's going off to school with a few issues. He was delicate, but I didn't want to treat him as a victim. I didn't want to. We didn't want to wrap him up in cotton wool. So we always had to find this balance. You know, the school had to be understanding. We wanted him to participate. We wanted him to be treated normally. I tried to treat him the same as his brother, and by and large we did, you know, with a few little adjustments here and there. But he did all the rough and tumble. I mean, this is a kid that had neurosurgery, significant neurosurgery. Anyway, when he was eight, he actually had another brain tumour. So he had that surgically removed and it turned out to be benign. So, you know, 8 years old, two neurosurgeries. 12 years old, he continued to develop. We decided to have the third child. So the five-year gap was because we were a little busy in that 5 years. Mm-hmm. So Joel came along. And in fact, that was the year. So I had Joel as a new baby and Samuel had a new brain tumour. So I had a new baby and a new brain tumour. So that was a very difficult year. 4 years later, Samuel had thyroid cancer. So he was in grade six. He had to have a thyroidectomy. And then that proved to be, thyroid cancer is generally pretty curable, but his was complicated. So for the next 10 years, his whole high school period at Melbourne Grammar was major neck surgery.
Excuse my ignorance. Is that a metastasis from the brain or is it a separate thing?
It was a new primary tumour. So the new meningioma was a new primary tumour and the thyroid cancer was a new primary cancer. The radiation that he had at the age of four, cranial spinal radiation to cure the brain tumour, the original deadly one, causes cancer later on. Okay. So he was at risk of further meningiomas, benign brain tumours, or malignant ones, and thyroid cancer because that's in the line of fire of the spinal radiation.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And thyroids are very susceptible to radiation. So he had very, very problematic thyroid cancer. But again, he played basketball, he played football, he went swimming, he was normal, he had a wonderful education at Melbourne Grammar. And that really was my life's work. My life's work was to make sure he was well, was alive, A, alive, B, well. That the family life, you know, I had two other children who weren't sick. I focused on all my children in different ways. They all got one-on-one time. They all got the things that they needed. That was my life's work. Do megalo ergo, you know, that really was my focus. While I was doing that over that sort of 15, 20 years, I managed to go back to university to get myself a classics and archaeology degree, which I was always really my first love. And then a little bit later, I was very interested in psychology because we had some difficult things to deal with Samuel and his brain. And I had to do a lot of reading, and so I ended up doing a psychology degree as well. So in those sort of the last decade, I started to, well, I'd always been interested in the Parthenon marbles. So perhaps we can segue to the Parthenon marbles now. Sure. You don't even have to ask the questions.
No, I'm liking these. I'm just enjoying them.
Start talking. I'm a little bit of a. I'm known in my family for talking a lot.
No, I wouldn't have had you otherwise.
No, me.
Okay, just to close up on the Samuel. Samuel lived to what age?
So, fast forward. Samuel was doing fine. He went to university. He went to Melbourne University. Got an arts degree. Majored in psychology. Did a master's degree in HR. Was just going beautifully. Was very happy, had time at college, was having a lovely old time, and then all of a sudden at 26 he went to one of his regular brain scans because obviously he was, he's an extremely scanned person. He had 130 MRIs, if you know what an MRI machine looks like in the tunnel. He had 130 of those, plus ultrasounds, plus all sorts of other CAT scans. He's had 200 procedures of some sort, his regular scan. And I was actually in Greece and he rang me and he said, "Mum, I've got a tumour." And I said, "Okay." So I was on the next plane home. We went to see the surgeon with his brothers. Four of us were there, and it was pretty grim. Mm-hmm. It had doubled in size in 6 weeks. Yep. So we knew it was pretty bad, and it was 2 days before Christmas, and three days before Christmas, and Prof K, at the wonderful one of Australia's top neurosurgeon at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, he said, "We have to take this out." I said, "When?" And he said, "Tomorrow." So we had less than a day to prepare for what was to be an unbelievably intrusive neurosurgery. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. The scar on the side, he had 50 staples on the side of his head. It was just so invasive. It was brutal. And he came out of the surgery. It was unbelievable. He wanted to see all his cousins, all the family rallied around. I have to tell you this funny story, because he, in the midst of all of this, that kid was so funny. All his cousins went in one by one, and he had their minute or two with him, and they all came out, and they were all, I mean, we were all standing around the bedside. We were just completely destroyed. And all the cousins came out one by one with a little smirk on their face. And we're all like, you know, the youngest one said, "Oh, you know, Samuel said I was his favourite cousin." And then the other one looked at him and said, "Well, Samuel said I was his favourite cousin." And then the other two, one by one, they said, "Well, he said I was his favourite cousin." So I'm saying, we were all like, oh, my, we were all laughing. There he was. He was so cheeky. He was so funny. He was just, he made everyone laugh. He was there with his head wrapped in bandages being hit by a Mack truck, and he made everybody laugh. And that was like, I said that anecdote because that really is a testament to him. He was such a plucky character. He had so much humour. He was hilarious.
You should be super, and I've said this to you, and I want to say it now officially as well in public, you should be damn bloody proud of raising not a victim, but a son who became a man.
Thank you.
And he lived a life.
He lived a life, you know, he did.
You didn't lose him at 4 years.
Yes, okay. And that was, thank you for saying that. That was one of our missions was, not to raise a victim, to raise a young man who was the best he could be, the best he could be at everything. And so he threw himself into everything, and he wasn't a victim. And, in fact, he used to volunteer at Peter Mac. He volunteered for 6 years on boards, on Youth Cancer Advisory Board. And, in fact, not long before he died, he was recognised by the Victorian Health Minister at the time, who gave him an award, and he was on the he was on the 6 o'clock news, and he didn't tell me, and I saw it on the news, and I saw it. He knew that he'd won this award, and we arrived there, and he won, and he pretended he was surprised, and it was all the surprise was on me, and he won, and he was so proud of it.
Yeah.
And it was Jill Hennessy, and she had interviewed him on television, and she was so proud of him too. So we all were, Peter Mack absolutely loved him, and his doctors all loved him, and we loved our doctors. Anyway, a few months later, he went downhill pretty rapidly, and he passed away in October of 2018.
Yeah.
So that was the end of a chapter of my life's work, of a very big part of my life. And obviously, I suddenly, because I got up every day for 23 years, that kid had cancer for 23 of his 27 years. And I realise now that I got up every day, you know, with a shield and a sword, and that's why I call myself Dragon Slayer.
And what impresses me about you is that you haven't put that shield and sword down. It's just changed focus now, and you're still incredibly active.
Yes,
this is let's jump backwards to the Parthenon marbles, because you, I won't say you've shifted your energy into something else. You've just added to your energy and your life's work.
Yes.
So now tell us a bit about the Parthenon Marbles. How did that come about, and what are you doing? What's going on there?
So I do seem to be someone who likes a battle. and gets energized by a noble fight, I suppose you'd have to call it. And so I had already, in the last sort of 5 years of our family life, I'd already joined the Australian Parthenon Committee with David Hill and George Vardis, two wonderful men who had been working in the cause for a long time. And I had always wanted to throw myself into something more civic, sort of outside. I mean, my family had been my world, and for good reason. And I hadn't really had the chance to have a professional life or a civic life. But, you know, going back to my father, I mean, he was my role model. And my father was my hero parent, I guess, because he showed me by his deeds and action what it was to be a civic person and to have civic responsibility.
Yep.
That wasn't rammed down my throat. I lived this civic life, and my dad was always a member of his community who rolled his sleeves up and did things, whether it was money, whether it was work. I mean, he did a lot of things with his hands. So I wanted to throw myself into something, and the Parthenon was always something that I felt very strongly about. I knew about Lord Elgin, this terrible man who took those marbles. I'd gone to the Parthenon as a little girl, so I wanted to do something about it. And so I threw myself into that, and I was in Greece. I was spending more time in Greece after my marriage had ended. And then after we lost Samuel, because that last 8 months of his life was a battle, and all of a sudden he was gone, and I was still on this. I had this cortisol running through my veins, which I realized I'd had for 23 years, which is why, you know, I have insomnia and what have you. So that had to go somewhere. That energy, nervous energy, that action had to have an outlet. And so I had been spending a lot of time in Greece after my marriage had ended, and I just ended up buying an apartment, and I live at the base of the Acropolis, which is extraordinary every day. I live near the Acropolis Museum. And I started to also realise that I had a voice, and I liked speaking, and I lived in the shadows of my ex-husband, who after Hey Hey It's Saturday was the voice of ABC Radio in the mornings. He was number one in Melbourne breakfast radio for 15 years. So, and I realised that I actually had a few things that I wanted to say. And so I found my voice after my marriage had ended, and I realised I had a lot to say, and I started making my little videos around Athens and posting them. And so mostly it was often about the Parthenon, but it was also about Athens and Greece. And when I would come to Cyprus, obviously I feel very strongly about Cyprus too.
Well, I've been in one of your videos when we did the tour of the old town.
Yes, that's right. And so, you know, I've become known for my little anecdotal videos and my traveling around Athens and Cyprus. And so the advocacy for the marbles. So we have a wonderful group in Australia, and we're very active on social media. We're one of the strongest committees around the world. Yeah. And three of us, Jim Mallis and George and myself, are probably the three most prolific social media posters on the Parthenon marbles, and certainly across all the platforms we have, you know, up to millions of views on our various posts over the years. So as an activist, I guess, you know, that has been a really good way for me to express this energy for a cause that, you know, is dear to my heart. I feel like, well, we're very close to a solution. I think we have a solution. Behind the scenes, we know that there is an agreement. We're very positive about that. We're waiting for an announcement. It's they're just nutting out the final details. I'm looking for a project in Cyprus. I think it's time to turn my energy to a project in Cyprus.
What could possibly be of interest in Cyprus?
Well, I do have an idea in Cyprus. Should I give you the scoop? I was going to actually keep it a secret. I would love to give you the scoop. Perhaps we can add an addendum. I think we need to keep it a little hush-hush right now, mm-hmm. but there is a project that I have in mind. There is an assemblage of artifacts that are partly in Cyprus and partly in another country.
Yep.
And it's time, I believe, that they were reunited in Cyprus because they are a key piece of our cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. They are unique in the world. There's only one other similar thing in another very large country, which is a tourist, Mecca. And I believe that this assemblage is a key piece of Cyprus's cultural heritage.
And if they were to return home successfully, they would be a Cypriot Mecca that would attract tourism, but not just tourism, but researchers, archaeologists.
Yes,
and,
yes, yeah. I would hope so. Yeah. I mean, it's a very key piece of history from the started in the Mycenaean Bronze Age, and I think this particular site and these figurines and things were from the Archaic period.
Yep.
Very, very important. So that, I think, is going to be my next project.
From what I know about it, and we've had off-air discussions, I think it's going to be something epic, something that can't be understated, and I think it's brilliant that someone like you, with your experience, but also with your I don't want to use the word Rottweiler tactics because that's got a negative connotation.
Oh my God,
to
don't
it.
Call me
no,
that.
No, but I mean it in a good way, that you're a go-getter.
A go-getter.
And you're dedicated, and I can see
an Amazon.
Yes.
Think of warrior princess. That's Athena. That's my kind of...
I can see
that's
you
my goddess role model.
I can see you continually putting fuel on the flames for this and keeping it alive. And I think that Cyprus has a lot to gain from someone like you being right in the center of that. So, we can't say much more, but I know that I'm looking forward to more news on that in the near future, and maybe another podcast can bring
that up. Yes, well, hopefully. Wouldn't it be lovely?
From the Parthenon to Cyprus, I think there's a very good lineage link between the two stories and the two processes. A little bit different, a little bit more friendly in the Cypriot.
Yes,
situation.
I've learned a lot being in the Parthenon Marbles campaign. I've seen the pitfalls. I've seen the things that have been done well, mm-hmm. things have been mistakes that have been made. I understand the people, the decision makers, and the ebb and flow of the decision makers and the political landscape. There's a whole array of things, factors involved in the actual solution. It doesn't mm-hmm. just happen because someone says so.
Yeah.
So I've seen that, and I've seen the pitfalls. I've seen what was good and what was not so good and how it was done. And so I hope to bring some of that knowledge and perspective and experience to this in Cyprus, because mm-hmm. I think actually fresh eyes outside are actually useful.
Yeah, not 100%. Totally agree with you. Well, look, for the last segment of our podcast today, mm-hmm. I want to ask you some questions about Cyprus and you. And
yes.
I'll begin with, what is your favourite place in Cyprus?
Oh, I have many favourite places in Cyprus.
Give us a couple of them.
I've been to all of the archaeological sites mm-hmm. Over the years. Look, I would have to say that Avros is my spiritual home. Every time I'm driving in the mountains there and we come around the bend waiting for the one where I see my beautiful mountain village. So that is my spiritual home. But look, I really love being inside the old city of Nicosia, Lefkosia. Mm-hmm. I just love those narrow streets, the Venetian walls, the bastions.
With history.
Oh my God, I just, in those tiny little narrow streets that and you wend your way and there's no straight lines, there's no straight streets. I mean, you could just blink and you will be in a medieval period.
Yep.
And I love our beautiful, those Gothic cathedrals. I have been to Famagusta. I can't say that I wasn't moved. I have been to the Katakomena. Mm-hmm. I've been to Kyrenia. I've been to the other side of Nicosia. It makes me very sad, extremely sad. I mean, how can a Cypriot of either side of the line, not be sad to see our beautiful island divided, because I remember 1974, and I'm an outsider. I'm a diaspora Cypriot, but I don't know. I couldn't say. I don't know what it's like to be a refugee, but I feel it. I feel Cypriot. Yeah. I feel the pain of our divided island. Everyone wants to see a solution. My favourite places are probably the historical, probably the medieval ones, although I do love the Roman mosaics in Paphos. I mean, those mosaics are beautiful. Yeah. Corion, the beautiful amphitheatre. How can you not, you know, can imagine being at that amphitheatre and seeing a show and seeing the, like seeing the sea. I mean, yeah. it's spectacular.
You just cast yourself back a couple thousand years.
You do.
Years and just
it's
think,
so easy.
How is it that, you know, 2,000-3,000 years ago, there were people sitting in this amphitheatre, looking out over the sea, watching some ancient Greek play.
Exactly.
You know, and then literally meters away, there's some mansions with mosaics
it's unbelievable.
You know, fountains it's and phaeums. I mean, it's incredible. Just down the road, there's an agora, and then come along the Byzantine period, cathedrals are being built.
Yes.
You know, so much magic.
And there are some lovely Ottoman buildings too. Yeah. You know, Buyuk Khan over on, you know, Nicosia, it's a beautiful building. And then the colonial buildings are lovely too.
Every person that has come through, ruled, or occupied,
has
left something beautiful.
Yes.
And it is great that we've kept it all, because in some cultures there's this rampant rush to remove the past that's not yours. So it's great that we've kept the mosques and we've kept the British columns. And you know, like we've done well.
Look, I think in
sense.
Some instances that's really important. Like on the Acropolis, they've removed Ottoman buildings and other, you know, the Frankish tower and all of that. It's just
although I don't know if the Frankish tower would like to have kept.
Yeah,
it's so
maybe. But look, they've paired it right back to the classical temple. But look, Cyprus.
That's one side. You can't do that for the whole
country. No, of course not. Yeah. And look, I think what's wonderful about Cyprus is that, you know, we've had 10,000 years of we have 10,000 years of history, 12,000 years of history. I've been to Hirokitia. I mean, that's a beautiful site to understand. You know, Stone Age. I mean, this is
Neolithic, that's
a Neolithic huts. Stone Age huts. I mean, it's extraordinary. Yeah. And so to see all of this in one place, to have continual history of all these incredible periods of history. Yeah. Mycenaean, Hellenistic,
well,
Roman.
Is one of the world's oldest continually happening cities.
Yes, like, Amethyst and Kithion there. I mean, it's extraordinary. So we're so lucky to have this. And, you know, I think we need to advertise it better to the world.
It
I think
needs
our
to be
tourism.
More than the sun, sand, and sea.
Yes,
it
I think that tired sort of tourism thrust has to really change.
I mean, we're now in the middle of March. Okay?
Yes. The weather's beautiful. It's 26 degrees today.
You can't see us, but we're wearing short sleeves.
Yeah.
The weekend coming up is going to be in the 30s. I mean, and this is early spring.
Look, I really look forward to our tourism message being modernised and
diversified.
It should be. We should be having, you know, the tourism infrastructure is improving. But we've got a beautiful product here to sell to the world.
Also, not just that, but if like you're gonna, if you believe that it's a struggle to get someone from as far away as Australia or Canada to come to just Cyprus, I understand that because there's big ticket items around us. You've got Egypt, you've got Greece.
Of course.
But what Cyprus could do is tap into the side travel, because a lot of people will travel multiple countries.
Yes.
So, like, you know, you come and visit Jordan or Egypt or Greece or Turkey and see these super amazing places. The side trip to Cyprus,
whilst
it might not be able to compete on scale to these places.
Yes, I mean, we don't have pyramids and we don't have the Acropolis.
But it does compete in culture, friendliness, hospitality,
look,
cuisine.
Of course, the people in Cyprus are just so kind, generous, open and lovely
and
funny. I mean,
it's a user-friendly island. It's
yes,
a very
it really
island.
Is. It
Tell
really
me,
is.
With Cypriot cuisine, well, yes. as I mentioned, what's your favourite foods?
Oh, look, I just hang out. I live in Athens, as you know, and I occasionally have souvlaki there, but, like, it's just nothing. I actually did, funnily enough, a year ago, I did a little post. I got a Cypriot mixed with Chef Tadja, and I said to my cousin, I'm going to do a video on this. But we did a video in the kitchen there and we posted it, and I sat down and had our souvlaki. But a few hours later, and by the next morning, it had 50,000 views.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was so funny. I just couldn't believe it. So, of course, I love Chef Tadja. I love Kupepia. I love flowness. I mean, flowness. I went in Athens for a great flowna hunt. I did a video on that. I found them in Athens. It's very, actually, quite difficult to find Chef Talies and Flonis in Athens. I love those kolokothopites with the pumpkin and the raisins. I love those. I forgot. Halloumi.
Halloumi,
we love halloumi. And of course, we were too embarrassed to take it to school in our lunches in primary school.
It's on every menu.
And now it's on every menu and it's trendy.
When I say every menu, I mean outside of Cyprus.
Every menu.
Like in Melbourne last year, there wasn't a menu without halloumi.
No, without halloumi. It's the swankiest cafes. You can have halloumi in your brunch. Yeah. I mean, in Melbourne.
Yep. No, it's all over the place. And I mean, look, the whole world knows camembert and brie, and they all know, you know, gorgonzola. And they
Halloumi
is well on its way to becoming a household name globally.
Oh, well, it is. It already is.
No, and I think we should be very proud of that. But I mean, like, look, Cypriot basturma is basturma. To die for. I mean, like, there's basturma in different parts of the world, but the Cypriot one is very different.
Yeah. Heromeri and lunza, all that stuff that they smoke up in the villages is so lovely.
No, look, I mean, look, I'm glad you're a foodie like me.
I'm a foodie.
I mean, you don't look like a foodie like me.
Well, I do like my food, but
Look, I'm looking forward to tracking your next moves, your next developments, your next visits to the island. This is a very short visit now, but I know you're going to be back in a few months. I'm looking forward to that. I do look forward as well, because you said that you're going to be in Melbourne at the end of the year when we're going to go back and visit. So
we'll
have to make sure that we hang out there as well.
We shall.
And try and find all the places that have good quality halloumi products.
We shall. Actually, one last thing. I just wanted to say that the Cyprus diaspora is really an important part of Cyprus and should not be forgotten. We have very incredible people in America, in Australia,
everywhere,
and the UK, everywhere. All around the world, who are doing incredible things. And, you know, this is a population outside of Cyprus that are really ambassadors for Cyprus. And I think they should be recognized.
There are some countries that understand the value of the diaspora. Israel is one of them.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Greece to an extent, Italy. There's a lot of countries that really understand the value of the diaspora and how it is one of the country's biggest assets.
It is. And I think the Cypriot diaspora is one of Cyprus's biggest assets.
And not to brag, but the Cypriot diaspora is an incredibly successful one. It's incredibly global. Just two weeks ago, I was in India. And in New Delhi, I discovered that there was a Cypriot there who, and the name evades me now, I apologize, but he's one of very few Cypriots known in New Delhi, and he's this textile guru. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, Cyprus, you go down on Asawada and Lydra Street in Nicosia, and there are textile shops everywhere. Mm. And I spoke to a few of them, and they're sourcing all their textiles from the UK. And I'm thinking, where's the UK sourcing them from? So I looked it up, India, of course. So basically, Cypriot people are buying Indian textiles via the UK. So you can imagine the inflation of the price. Meanwhile, you've got this fellow over in Delhi doing what he's doing, being super successful at it, and the Cypriot world has no clue that this man's out there. And I've seen it with an amazing Cypriot chef in Bangkok. I mean, I'm talking about countries where you wouldn't think Cypriots exist.
Look, I think it's up to the individual to sort of make a connection with the mothership, but there needs to be a mechanism for that to happen. The diaspora offices in Cyprus have to be set themselves up in a way that they're very accessible, that they're contacted easily, that you're easy contact. You know, the interface has to be, if someone arrives on the doorstep and contacts you, you want to welcome them. We need to be welcomed with open arms, because someone to reach out, they need to be connected easily.
I have an example of a good friend of mine, Baris, in Shanghai. Okay. He was actually the top graphic design marketing agent for Toyota. So Toyota China had a Cypriot at the helm. And he reached out constantly to Cyprus and unfortunately was basically blanked.
Yes.
And I mean, I thank the previous ambassador of Cyprus to China who helped him quite a bit. Shout out to you, Martha. But unfortunately, he's still there and he's doing amazing. And the Chinese love him. And he's making big money for these companies.
They need to be acknowledged. They need to be acknowledged, supported, celebrated. Yeah. some media, like it needs to be, and then that sort of will feed into other possibilities.
I'm going to mention as well, kudos to Paul Lambis with the Cyprus Diaspora Forum, because he is kind of in a private capacity doing that.
Well, yes.
And it's in its second iteration.
Second
this year.
So we're looking forward to attending that this year. Last year was fantastic.
We're going to make some noises always.
We're going to make some noises, yes. It's a business networking conference, but it has culture and all sorts of other elements to it. It's a really wonderful way for diaspora Cypriots to connect in Cyprus and meet each other. And this has been missing, and it'd be really nice to have some government attendance as well this
year. I think there will be this year from what I've been told.
I think that's really important because we need a forum to connect and that's what Paul's been able to do.
You and I were both there last year, and Paul did an amazing job bringing people from all over the world together.
He did. And we got to meet wonderful Cypriots.
I mean, like your fireside chats, like with
Dasula Hajitofi, wonderful.
And then the other panels with all the entertainers.
It was lovely. It was so nice. I'm looking forward to doing that again.
I enjoyed that.
Year.
And this year again, I'm going to be on the Diplomats channels.
Lovely.
Look, we're excited about that. Paul, I know you're listening, so we're very excited about that. And
we're looking forward to it again this year.
Definitely we are.
It's been wonderful.
On that note, I want to thank you. We've just hit an hour.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, time flies.
We said 40 minutes, didn't we?
Yeah. But look, thank you so much for giving me your time in this channel.
Thank you. And also I'd like to acknowledge your work. You know, you've been here from Melbourne, Australia. You've been here 20 years. You worked for the Australian High Commission. You had a wonderful career there, and now you're a consultant and a podcaster, and you're a man about town doing all sorts of things. If I want to know something that's happening in Cyprus, you're my go-to, one of my go-to people. So shout out to you, and thank you for your wonderful friendship. We've had a few laughs over the years.
I appreciate that. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much, Elimo.
Thank you.
And talk to you soon.
Thank you, Costa. Thank you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.